Welcome to Tower Talks with Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast. And now for your weekly recap, a timely review of this week's top headlines and takeaways. Here's your host.
Welcome to Inside Towers Week in Review. I'm Leslie Stimson, Inside Towers Washington Bureau Chief. This episode is sponsored by Inside Towers Intelligence. It's a quarterly market report that dives deep into the wireless infrastructure ecosystem. Intelligence looks at market trends, capital expenditures, relevant M&A transactions, and more. The 2023 Volume 4 issue is available now. So an annual subscription also includes an exclusive briefing and online support. For more information or to subscribe, visit insidetowers.com/intelligence. So John, there's a lot of earnings calls this week, and did you want to, I guess I should just start you off.
Yes, Leslie, it was a tidal wave of earnings reports this week. The ones that we follow closely, the mobile network operators, the tower companies and the vendors have checked in, at least the big three mobile network operators, AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile. And Crown Castle amongst the tower companies. But, you know, we're seeing a bit of a similar pattern here amongst the wireless companies that their revenues have generally been up in the order of about 3% year to year. They've added subscribers, particularly postpaid subscribers, to the tune of low single digits. And they've moderated their network investments. Their capital expenditures were down compared to the prior year, and their outlook for the coming year is that it'll be flat to down as well, mainly because they're suggesting their network buildouts have reached some kind of steady state where they passed a very high active phase in deploying C-band. Certainly we've had the T-Mobile and Sprint network integration that took a lot of investment, and Dish has tailed off. It's at once it met its 70% population coverage requirement, but I think all of the companies, and it's interesting that their ability to add new subscribers is at a fairly low rate, like I said, single digit percent increase year over year, but the revenues are growing mainly on the strength of increasing prices. They talk about value plans, how their network is now at a point where it's got more capability. They're able to offer better coverage, better services, or a mix of services to customers, and that's bumping up the average revenue per month, per user and per account. So, in the case of a couple of highlights, in the case of Verizon, fixed wireless access was a bright spot for them. They added, they reported 3.1 million consumer and business connections at the end of 2023. And maintained that they will reach 4 to 5 million fixed wireless subscribers by 2025. The other area of growth for them was their fiber business, but their Fios fiber to the premise network added about 400,000 premises in the past year, and they reached 7.4 million connections, about half of all their wireline broadband, and they're still targeting to expand that by close to a million subscribers a year for the next several years. Their CapEx guidance is in the $17 to $17.5 billion for the year. Now, this includes wireline. We estimate that the wireless portion is about $9 to $10 billion of that. They're calling it what the CEO Hans Vestberg refers to as business as usual CapEx. And so this guidance for 2024 is down from the $18.8 billion they spent in 2023. And I think it reflects the winding down of their, as I mentioned, their accelerated spending for C-band in the prior 2 years. They did point out that about 80% of their fixed wireless connections are in markets where C-band is deployed, and that's primarily in the top 76 metro areas, including what we call NFL cities. And these markets are built out. Once Verizon received clearance for C-band in the remaining markets, then they're looking to roll out C-band in a measured way in suburban and rural markets. And they did point out that they're densifying their networks in urban markets with C-band and millimeter wave on small cells. So, you know, that's an interesting development. AT&T kind of echoed the same kind of remarks, in as much as is wireless service revenues were up 4% year over year. Their 5G network now covers 250 million people. They added about 2.4 million postpaid and prepaid customers for the year, but that was down from the 4.6 net adds they had in 2022. And I think that reflects a fair amount of caution on the part of consumers about switching carriers or upgrading their service, mainly because, you know, we're still living with high interest rates and high cost of living. So that I think consumers in general have been a little more cautious about making that switch. AT&T says its fiber network build-out is progressing. It's currently reaches 26 million passings at the end of 2023, and it's still on track to meet its goal of 30 million passings by 2025. During the earnings call, CEO John Stankey suggested that they might raise that goal of homes passed to, or premises passed to, by 10 or 15 million over the next couple of years, as long as they are continuing to see good returns on that investment, actually better than expected returns on their fiber investment as they build out the network. So their total fiber connections, actually paying customers, reached 8.3 million. That was up 1.1 million for the year. And the company pointed out this is the sixth consecutive year that they've added more than 1 million fiber connections. They did talk about their fixed wireless access service, which they call AT&T Internet Air. They're not going at it the same way as T-Mobile and Verizon in terms of making fixed wireless available on their 5G network. They're being more strategic about it. Looking to deploy fixed wireless maybe ahead of a fiber installation, or perhaps in areas where they're not going to put fiber. They did say they reached 95,000 connections in 35 locations at the end of the year, adding about 65,000 in the quarter alone. So they also guided to lower capital spending for the year. They were down about 9% in 2023 compared to the prior year. Again, they don't break out their wireless CapEx. We estimate that about 45 to 50% of their total CapEx goes to their wireless network. For the year, AT&T expects its CapEx to be in the 21 to 22 billion range. That's a 9% decline from the year before. And its capital intensity, meaning the ratio of CapEx to service revenues, they expect to decline as well. On the arguing that we're more capital efficient, our network is built out to a certain point, we're driving more signups and more customers and more revenue streams, and we don't have to spend as much money. The guidance suggests that their wireless CapEx will drop below so the network expansion levels to more of a slow build or maintenance mode. So the other company that we did cover in detail is Crown Castle. Crown Castle is at an interesting juncture in its evolution. Went through quite a bit of turmoil the latter half of 23 when And we covered this. Elliott Management, an activist investor, bought a big stake and it called for management changes and a reevaluation of the company's strategy in fiber and small cells. As a result of former CEO Jay Brown retired, that's in air quotes, and the board is in the process of searching for a new CEO, and at the same time is conducting a strategic review of its fiber and small cell business. So, but lo and behold, through it all, the company really performed in line with its guidance, and for the most part, management says they're conducting business as usual. Their leasing revenues were down 1%, a mix of site rentals that were up 4%, but the services revenue were down 36%, reflecting the slowdown in the support that the tower company provides to the mobile network operator tenants. Its tower business is stable. The tower count virtually the same as last year. It was a few decommissions and sales, but around the 40,000 tower count for the U.S. market. It has, small cells is still an active area for it. Company says it has 115,000 small cell nodes, either installed or under contract. Last year it guided to it that would install 10,000 small cells in 2023. It managed to get 8,000 of those activated, and there's a carryover about 2,000 that is will be completed and activated in the first quarter of this year. It says it has a backlog of 50,000 small cells, plans to deploy another 14,000 in 2024. One interesting point they made is that it said that about 60% of these small cell nodes that it installs today are co-location sites, meaning that a small cell could support two or maybe three mobile carriers in one pole, in one small cell node. A few years ago, most of its business was, the majority of its business was for a single carrier per site. So there's been a bit of a flip here, and part of it, I think, has to do with economics. Part of it has to do with coverage. But Crown Castle, is still applying its shared infrastructure model to small cells as it does for towers. So the interim CEO, Tony Malone, said the strategic review of the small cells business, fiber and small cells business, is underway. And, without indicating how it may pan out, he said all options are still on the table. The company has long-term master lease agreements with the big three, and it has visibility to about 75% of organic revenue through 2027. So its business is still concentrated with the big three. T-Mobile accounted for 36% of its total, AT&T and Verizon were 19%, and then the balance was distributed among other carriers. So its outlook for discretionary capital expenditures for 2024 is in the 1.5 to 1.6 range, and about 90% of that is going to fiber and the balance to towers. So, we're seeing, progress in the business, but the slowdown has had its effect in the past year. I think the commentary we're hearing from a number of analysts is that maybe we're starting to come out of it. So we're going to keep an eye on that.
John, wasn't their small cell strategy one of the bones of contention for Elliott?
Yes, it was, and that's what I mentioned. They're undergoing a strategic review to decide: are they going to keep it? Are they going to sell it? Are they going to what are they going to do? And at this point, the company is saying we're still looking at the situation, and all and any options are certainly being evaluated.
Did they say exactly what they don't like about the small cell strategy? The returns aren't big enough, or what's their beef?
Well, like I mentioned, their capital expenditure guidance of 1.5 to 1.6 for next year includes 1.4 for fiber, and fiber represents the minor part of their revenues. So you have this huge investment for for the return, and so they're questioning, is it worth it? And you know, all along Crown Castle has felt it was, that it balances their tower business, and that it the long-term prospects for network densification using small cells on fiber seem to be a good way to go. But LA seemed to think, you know, you're spending a lot of money investing in this and we're not getting the returns, you ought to rethink it. So that's where we're at with it.
John, do any of the analysts ask about the lead sheath cable issue anymore?
Yeah, I think it did come up in the in one of the calls, AT&T perhaps, and their position is the same. They've done their own evaluation. They determined there's not a problem. They've turned over all the information they have to the EPA and other bodies that are investigating. But I think there's no determination has been made yet as to what's going to happen. But they both Verizon and AT&T, who would hold a large portion of it, they both say that lead sheath cable is a minor part of their infrastructure. They haven't found any problems with it, and they're working in full cooperation with the authorities, taking a look at it to see what, if anything, may end up needing to be done. But right now, they said they've done all they can do, and they've turned over all the information, so it's out of their hands. But we'll see.
I'm asking because I got a call yesterday from someone whose company has stock in AT&T and Verizon. And this company is trying to figure out if there's going to be a monetary hit from that issue. And I said, well, you know, same, essentially what you're saying, they're cooperating, and it's becoming really, you and I were talking on the podcast a while before, it's really hard to determine who owned what when these cables were laid, because these companies have been bought and sold several times since then, and there might not be accurate records, you know, saying who owns what. And I said, from a policy standpoint, what I'm reading is, you know, the EPA isn't hopping up and down now and saying, oh, it's a crisis, it has to be remediated right now. No, they're still gathering information. And then if there would be remediation, the question would be, who would pay for it? And that's an open question. Would it be a combination of private money, public money, you know, mm-hmm. all that's mm-hmm. down the road. So I think it'll be interesting to see if EPA comes out with something like a report, maybe in the summer when all this first came to mm-hmm. light. Mm-hmm. We'll mm-hmm. see. So
my take on what has been released so far is that if there is some kind of remedial action that needs to be taken, I would expect it wouldn't be that costly in the whole scheme of things, you know, compared based on what they're saying, that the amount of lead sheath cable in the network mm-hmm. is pretty small amounts by comparison to their total infrastructure. So, but you're right. You know, we'll just have to wait and see when a report comes out, what, if anything, needs to be done and what that might cost. But right now they're playing it, they're downplaying the impact of that, and I think trying to set expectations low that there might be a big fallout for a bit. From what I'm reading, I don't get that.
So switching to policy, the FCC did a couple of important things at their meeting that we cared about on Thursday. One thing is they made participation in their disaster information reporting system mandatory for wireline, wireless, cable, and VoIP providers. And they did that because they say not everybody is participating, and so they don't have a complete idea during a disaster or afterwards of the communication status in an area. And that's a problem because other federal and state and agencies, including FEMA, depend on the FCC's numbers. So they want it to be more complete. And so the nationwide carriers would have 6 months. Once the rules are implemented, the nationwide carriers would have 6 months to implement them. smaller carriers would have 24 months, and they're doing that, giving them more time because the smaller carriers have fewer resources. And Eddie, you and I were talking before we got on the broadcast that they didn't make it mandatory for broadcasters. They are asking in a separate notice of proposed rulemaking, should they do that? So that's interesting because most broadcasters do participate. So, yeah. Another story, they want to change the routing of wireless 911 calls. They right now the calls are based on the location of the nearest cell tower to the caller, but that may not route the call to the correct 911 call center. And that's especially a problem near a border area. It's true here. I mean, I live in Maryland, but the district is, right there. There's a lot of misrouted calls in the district. So what the FCC is doing is they want the carriers to implement location-based routing for wireless 911 calls. Oh, and also real-time text to 911. They would have 6 months to implement the change once the rules are enacted. And during the vote, Nathan Symington said he was happy to support the item because it can make a difference between emergency services being able to help and arriving too late to make a difference. So specifically, the rules would require the wireless carriers to deploy location-based routing on IP-based networks, 4G LTE, 5G, and then subsequent networks. And the carriers must certify and submit evidence of compliance. And then I wanted to take a quick hit, lastly, at the Affordable Connectivity Program. That's if it doesn't get more money, it's supposed to go away soon. It would run out of money in May, the FCC thinks. But pretty soon, providers have to start notifying the people who get it that they have to switch. And so New Street Research did a survey on who might be affected and how. And they think the numbers suggest that this is according to Blair Levin, their policy advisor. The numbers suggest that there's a high level of uncertainty concerning the ability and the willingness to pay related to about 70% of the ACP recipients. And they break it down into customers who have had broadband before, which the commission thinks is about 20%. Those who have had broadband in the past, but their finances are iffy. So when they don't think they can pay other bills, they drop their broadband and then come back on later. And the FCC thinks about half of the recipients, which is about 23 million, fit into this category. And then bucket C are customers who have had broadband before, and they took advantage of the ACP subsidy to either upgrade the service or use the savings for other purposes. So it'll be interesting to see what happens because 174 mayors signed a letter asking Congress to continue funding the program. And but overall, New Street Research doesn't have high hopes for the program continuing because of the political machinations going on in Congress right now. He said, well, a straight up or down vote on the ACP would likely pass. New Street Research doesn't think House leadership would allow the legislation to reach the floor. So it'll be interesting to see if ACP really continues.
You know, Leslie, that question came up in the conference calls with the carriers,
Oh,
and they all kind of responded in the same way. T-Mobile said it didn't think that there was very much of its base that were ACP supported subscribers. I think AT&T and Verizon felt it was a proportion of it, but that they were kind of waiting and seeing what would happen. But It's obviously it affects large numbers of people, but it affects the carriers in different ways,
Yeah.
depending on which customer base they're supporting. And I thought it was interesting that T-Mobile said it. They thought the numbers were pretty tiny. Yeah.
Yeah, New Street Research thought maybe some could be transferred to another tier of service for their carriers,
Yeah.
but they don't think the majority will be able to because they just can't afford it. So that's a wrap. Thank you for listening to Inside Towers Week in Review. And this is a reminder for a complete rundown of all the week's stories. Check out our Saturday edition. We'll see you in a week.
Thank you for listening to Tower Talks. To subscribe to our podcast, our daily newsletter, or use our other industry resources, please visit InsideTowers.com. Until next time, you've been listening to Tower Talks from Inside Towers, the wireless infrastructure industry's podcast.